Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Face Us, the radio show where we confront the serious corruption happening in courtrooms across America and the world. Today's courts are riddled with problems stemming from the unchecked greed and unethical behavior of court-appointed and for-hire attorneys and other court officials. We stand with the honest and honorable judges and attorneys and service professionals trying to clean up this mess and restore integrity to our justice system. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It's time to face us. Today is Wednesday, September 27th, 2023, and I'm Robin Austin. I'm with my co-host, Luann Fleming.
Hi, my name is Luann Fleming. How are you? How is all of our listeners tonight and everybody else doing?
Welcome to the show.
Welcome to the show. We also have Hillary Holgers with us. Say hello, Hillary.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to all of our listeners throughout the country. And we thank you. And again, just to repeat, we are here for you in what for most people will be the worst experience in your life, dealing with the local court system that's basically keeping our loved ones hostage for money. So we are with you. We are proud and happy to be here helping the country learn about guardianship and what it's all about, and it's not good. So thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you for coming on with us. We also have Marcy Friedman. She is joining us. Say hello to everyone.
Good evening, America, and I am saying good evening, brava, America.
There you go.
And remembering my mother, I just wanted to say thank you to Diane Diamond for her courageous book, writing We're Here to Help When Guardianship Goes Wrong. And I wanted to read a little quick reference that what a lawyer wrote. It says, a tenacious reporter and skillful writer Diane Diamond used his compelling stories of real people to pull back the curtain on a guardianship system shrouded in secrecy, where power, greed, and influence all too often intersects with devastating consequences for the people the system is intended to protect, and for their loved ones. It is a powerful book, and this was the one who wrote this is Ken Walls. He's a lawyer, a journalist, and a former editor-in-chief of the Albuquerque Journal. I think the book is amazing. I'm reading it. I think she took a lot of courage to write it. Diane is an investigative reporter as well. She's an award-winning freelance journalist. She's an author, syndicated columnist, and former television correspondent who specializes in crime and justice topics. She has appeared on National Public Radio, WCBS TV, New York, Hard Copy, The Today Show, MSNBC and CNBC, Court TV, Investigation Discovery Channel, and has written for Newsweek, Huffington Post, The Daily Beast, The New York Post, Real Clear Investigations, and The Albuquerque Journal. She is the author of Be Careful Who You Love, Inside the Michael Jackson's Case, Cirque du Sahabi, and Be Careful Who You Trust, and Thinking Outside the Crime and Justice Box. So I encourage everyone to get this book, and I'm even buying extra copies to give them to some senators and to give them as gifts. So there's a lot of insight, and it is full of true stories of these horrendous crimes, taking advantage of the elderly, the mentally disabled, suffering from incapacities of Alzheimer's and dementia, and turning those behaviors against the daughters or the son in order for them to rape the estate, isolate them, which in my opinion is a public health hazard, and it needs to stop.
There you go. Perfect.
Hello?
Yeah. I think that's great, Marcy. I mean, she done a wonderful book, you know. So, yeah, let's talk about that a little bit, and then we'll go ahead and get to our guest. We've got a wonderful guest coming on, Badine Diamond. She's been a well-known journalist for many years, and she's a well-known being a journalist. So
I think it's wonderful that she's shining a light in this arena.
Mm-hmm.
It's wonderful to have a very capable journalist that is bringing her considerable skills to shining a light where it is very desperately needed in the arena of these guardianships. So pick up the book. It's an excellent read. I think you'll enjoy it.
There you go. So let's see. Keeler, is anything else did you want to say before we bring in our guests? Anybody?
I just want to let everyone know that there was a Zoominar yesterday with Laura Sterling in Orlando. She represented Rebecca Fearley in most of her guardianship cases. And Rick Black and I were on, and she answered one of my questions. And after that, she censored us. She would not let either of us answer. So if this was a normal business, they would be out of business. But in guardianship, anything goes. So basically everything is status quo, and we are continuing the fight.
Yeah, there you go.
No, it's rare that anyone on the other side of the bar will actually take questions from those of us that know the damage and see the damage and make the attempt to hold them accountable. So I'm glad she at least took a question.
Right. There is
you go. Well, you know, yeah. Like I say, our next guest is going to fill us in a lot of issues that are coming on. Let me tell you a little bit about our guest, okay? So let's see. Actually, I wanted to name it. The first time I talked to him, he says, let's follow the money. So I decided to put that on as one of the headlines. We're joined by Ken Ditkowski. He's 87 years old, everybody, a retired attorney of 54 years from Cook County, Chicago, Illinois. Our discussion tonight is about guardianship abuse, nursing home dangers, proving RICO, wire fraud, and the new statutes, guardian breach of fiduciary duty, and more. I mean, there was such a large list that I left it, but some of the main ones. And I wanted to let you know that even though Ken was ready to retire, his license was suspended for 4 years when he complained about a judge. He was charged with filing false pleadings that he never did. He said no attorneys are willing to take on guardianship cases. They're in danger themselves. We don't need any more legislation. We need enforcement. And going to the IRS could help bring justice to unethical court officials. And like I say, Ken will be happy to answer any questions, so please call into our radio show. And that phone number is 419-9962. You press a 1. And sometimes, you have to press a 1 in there if you have a different telephone service or something. Put an 845-241-9962.
And that would be some phone services. You're required to hit 1-845-241-9962 to get in without you know, some phone services charge by the minute or something. So that is one way that has worked for some to get around that. And also, if you do call in, 845-241-9962 with a question for our guest or a comment, then that's when you press a 1. Once you're on with us, you can press a 1, and that'll raise your hand and let us know that you have a question or a comment. So I'm really excited to talk with Mr. Ditkowski.
Yes.
And
so we're going to go ahead and bring him in. Let's go ahead and bring him in. I've had so many people talk about him and the work he's done, and some people want to come in and join on the conversation. They've asked to come on, so I told them, yes, go ahead and call into the number. So right now we've got Ken joining us. Ken, welcome to our radio show.
Hi.
Welcome.
I'm glad to be here. I'd like to mention another book that
that's kind of a do-it-yourself type of thing by Dr. Sam Sugar, where he examined the guardianship from an intimate point of view. And it's a very interesting book. There are a bunch of these books that are out there. But, you know, there's one thing about guardianship. Not all guardianships are bad.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of many of these autistic people, they do need a guardianship. And families come in and they do tremendous work. Where you have the problem with the professional guardians and with corrupt courts. In Cook County here, we've got a real problem because we have got a really corrupt system. It's so bad that in the Salas case, as an example, here's a man that he and his wife saved and scrimped for a lifetime. They put together a money pot of about $8 million. A guardian came in, and the first thing the guardian did, even before Mrs. Salas was declared incompetent, they went after joint tenancy accounts. You can't do that. The 14th Amendment says you can't do it. But they did it. And then 2 years later, or maybe it was 3 years later, she was found to be incompetent. But they didn't comply with the statute. We have a very specific statute here in Illinois that requires clear and convincing evidence of the incompetence. And they didn't bother to do it. They just appointed a guardian. And one thing that they totally ignore is the fact the guardian's a fiduciary. As a fiduciary, a guardian cannot do anything unless his action is, one, reasonable, two, necessary, and three, it benefits the ward. And in the appointment statute in Illinois, it actually says something very close to that. This is the situation that we have here in Illinois. We have it across the country. And it's so bad that we have actually blood-curdling articles coming out of places like the New Yorker magazine, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Huffington Post, and nothing occurs. It's all we get is more legislation, and there's no need for it. Now, if you have specific questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Right.
I can cite you statutes. There is one statute that has come down. It came out of the Obamacare Act, and in Illinois, it's a statute that provides for triple damages and attorney's fees in the civil side, and the criminal side, it makes it a felony. And with the amount of money that's involved in these cases, very serious felonies. And you can't get enforcement. You can't find an attorney who mentions it. If you go to see an attorney and talk to him about it, how about bringing a lawsuit on behalf of Mr. Salas? You've got $8 million in damages from just the theft times three. That's $24 million. Mr. Salas will give a portion of that besides the attorney's fees you're entitled to. A young attorney who starts this off can wind up with a fortune. He can make more money on this in 1 year than he can make in an entire practice because of the triple damages and attorney's fees.
Mm-hmm.
And no one wants to touch it.
Right. That's what I was going to ask you. There's probably no attorneys that will touch it because they're afraid of being sanctioned themselves, right?
Oh, yeah. We have a kind of a funny situation. We had this COVID thing. And with COVID, it meant the courts closed up. So we had Zoom hearings. And Dean Salas wanted to attend the hearings involving his wife. So I contacted an attorney by the name of Joanne Dennison, and Joanne said, I'll teach you how to use the teach it. Well, that got to the Guardian. Guardian filed a complaint with the IADC, the Illinois Attorney Registration and Disciplinary Commission of the Illinois Supreme Court. They acted immediately. They sent out a, quote, trial attorney, unquote, to question Mrs. Dennison. Mm-hmm. And then they proceeded to send out a subpoena for Mr. Salas's Google account. Salas isn't an attorney. He's an ordinary individual who's being harassed and the victim of predation. Why are they doing that? How do they have a basis to do it? And has anybody ever heard of the 14th Amendment?
Wow.
No,
and that's,
go ahead.
And that's where we stand. This is how we operate in Illinois. If you complain, watch your license. And this is, unfortunately, this is across the country. You have these things consistently. Anybody who complains about a judge who's engaged in this thing or the attorneys that are involved in this thing wind up having to deal with their licenses. I got charged with filing false pleadings. I wasn't even part of the case. I hadn't filed a pleading. The judge fined me $5,000. It's not $5,000, $4,000-something, almost $5,000. I took an appeal and won. Next thing I know, there they are after my license.
Wow.
No one worries about the Fourth or 14th Amendment. It's money that's involved. In these cases, the first thing they do is go after the house and the savings. That places the person in real jeopardy. And how do you deal with it? How do you deal with it? You got to get our politicians, our state's attorneys, attorney generals, to bring prosecutions. This is a crime. Violation of the 14th Amendment is a crime. If you file in the federal court under 42 U.S.C. 1983, the court will throw you out, and the federal court will say, we're not in the business of correcting the errors of the state court. And they're not. Real violations occurring here of human rights, civil rights.
Mm-hmm.
No problem whatsoever, and the court won't touch it.
Right. So tell me this. What can people do to – I know we were talking earlier yesterday, and you were talking about a lot of things. You were talking about nursing home dangers, proving RICO. I mean, let's start with one of these. Let's go ahead with proving RICO. Can you talk about that first, and then we'll get into some other
RICO
topics?
RICO is very difficult to prove. It requires two acts of something like mail fraud, wire fraud, two independent acts. And if you don't have those two independent acts, you don't have RICO. Mm-hmm. Now, in many of these business cases, of course, you can find the two acts. But in terms of the individual, there's no way in the world you have two separate acts of mail fraud or wire fraud or something along these lines. So you're going to get thrown out. If you can, and then you have a problem in the federal court, is the federal court requires a clear, concise statement of your claim upon which relief can be granted. If you're going to prove two acts and you're going to plead it and prove it, you're not going to have a clear, concise statement. There's no way. Now, what they do in the criminal court is they attach everything, and it's incorporated by reference. But in the state court, you're not going to get away with it. The judge doesn't want it anyway. And then if you finally get to a situation where you got RICO case you can try. It's a difficult case to try. It's time-consuming. The one that I tried took a whole month, and it got done. The jury came in with a very favorable verdict. But we also proved tax evasion. And guess who was watching? The Department of Treasury. So they filed a jeopardy assessment. They came before us. We never collected a dime.
Oh, God. Oh, my
God. This is what you're going to prove in these cases. If I'm a fiduciary, like a guardian, and I steal money, that's theft. Now, the fact that I stole it doesn't exempt me from taxes. It means I have to pay the taxes, and I have to report it, and I have to report it in the year I stole it. And if I don't do it, I incur penalties and interest. If I steal the money and don't report it on my tax return, I can have a 50% fraud penalty. In the Salas case, there could be $4 million in taxes that should be assessed.
Right.
Wow.
And then it goes and there's interest on that. It goes on every year. And it goes on until somebody reports it in their tax return. And then when it's reported in the tax return, at that point in time, the statute of limitations runs. The criminal is a little different, but the tax amount of money is there. And then, of course, Illinois has a tax, and there's money there.
Right.
But they don't collect it. Our state is almost on the verge of bankruptcy, and they're not interested. They're not interested in collecting the money from the thief that helped himself to the Salas estate.
Right.
Let me ask you something. You said that if it's not reported that year, there's a 50% fraud penalty. I think we were discussing the IRS, and it seems to me that would be federal. Is this
federal?
A nationwide law?
Yeah. It's a nationwide law. And that's the reason on every one of these emails I send out, you'll notice I copy the Department of the Treasury. At one time, the Department of the Treasury said, we investigate every tip we get.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they still do it. Now, there's one problem of reporting things to the Department of the Treasury. They do an investigation of two people. One, the person who reports it, and two, the person who is accused. So you can wind up reporting and wind up having a tax audit yourself. And that's kind of a deterrent.
Right.
But
right.
The amounts of money are great, and they do pay a finder's fee.
Wow.
They pay a finder's fee?
Oh, yeah.
How is that?
You report the person who stole money, and if they collect it, you get a portion of it. I don't remember what it is, but it's a piece of change.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
We have
laws in this country for everything. The problem is we don't enforce them.
Right.
Right.
And people are not crying about it and not going in and not saying to the government, hey, how about enforcing the law? Yeah, we know. We know that Mr. So-and-so, who's appointed guardian in such and such a case, makes big contributions to the dominant political party. We know how valuable he is, but he stole money, and he's reporting it fraudulently. For instance, in the Salas case, there was a mortgage foreclosure. And the case is Byline Bank versus Amy Salas. And if you read it, it's an amazing case because it violates every ethical principle possible, every fiduciary law possible, and our statute. It doesn't matter, and the judge just overlooks it, and the court just pushed it aside. Nobody was interested in the rule of law. And
wow.
This was not, when I first started practice in 1961, this wasn't the law. This wasn't the way judges handled cases.
Right.
When you had a case like D1, 62, 63, all the way into the 1980s, the judge would look at this Salas case and say, how is Mrs. Salas signing mortgage documents? The statute says she can't. And it furthermore says that if she does sign it, any document she signs is void. And the loan is void.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge would throw it out. In this case, the judge said, oh, no problem. Not only that, the guardian went into court in an attempt to validate a void loan. Never told the judge that Mrs. Salas, who she found to be incompetent without any findings of fact, conclusions of law, signed a commercial mortgage. Do you know the difference between a commercial mortgage and a home loan?
No.
A commercial loan doesn't have the protections of a home loan. And it does, and it can, a commercial loan in many cases has a clause that says, in the event that the lender shall feel insecure, he shall have the right to declare the entire mortgage due and payable. How would you sign it? Would you feel comfortable having that as a home loan? But it's in your, if you got a loan on your business, you might very well have it.
Wow.
Now tell me that clause again. In the event, what?
In the event that the lender shall feel insecure, he shall have the right to declare the entire mortgage due and payable.
Right.
Does that make you warm and fuzzy?
Oh, God.
Wow.
But that's in a lot of the commercial loans. And to be fair, that was not in the Byline Bank loan. But
well,
it was.
Kim, when you go ahead and keep talking about that bank loan, because I wanted to know if is it the same as, okay, so you take out a loan on a house, right?
Yeah.
So is it stronger?
The bank,
loan
has a commercial loan is for a shorter period of time at a higher rate of interest, and there are usually provisions in there that are procrustean.
Okay.
In the home loan situation, the courts have put in protections and made an effort to make it so people can redeem. It's not good business for a bank to run foreclosures. It really isn't. It's very bad business. If I'm dealing with a bank and that bank treats me unfairly, as a homeowner, a year or so down the line, or maybe 10 years down the line, I may be in a position to send business to that bank, and they've made an enemy out of me. They don't need to make an enemy out of me. And when they make an enemy out of me, they make an enemy out of my son, my daughter, my son-in-law, my neighbor.
Right. Yeah. Anybody that you have their ear, you're going to, because, you know, I mean, when I was in the restaurant business, I recall one day my manager said, guys, guess what I've learned today? And he said, American Express has done some research. And when someone is pleased with our restaurant, do you know how many people they tell? Well, the answer is generally zero. He said, mm-hmm. Do you know how many people they tell when someone is displeased?
Oh,
the
yeah.
The average is seven.
Everybody in sight. I have a funny story there, too. My wife and I went on a vacation, got camping vacation. And we got to the Twin Cities, or the Quad Cities here, here at the border of Illinois and Iowa. And I discovered I didn't have any cash. And those were the days where you paid cash. Now it's called credit cards.
Uh-oh.
And I walked into a bank, and I wanted to cash a $50 check. I walked up and went to the teller, and she told me, you've got to talk to an officer. So I talked to an officer, and the officer said to me, do you bank here? I said, no, I bank in Chicago. She says, well, if you don't bank here, I can't lend you any money. So I walked into the president's office of the bank, and I said, I'd like to cash a $50 check. And he was about as interested in cashing my check as he would have been welcoming a flood. And he basically ushered me out of the bank. So I went across the street. There was another bank. I went directly to the president's office, and I said, sir, I'd like to cash it. I'm from Chicago. Here's my identification. I'd like to cash the $50 check. And he cashed the check. And I went home and went the next morning after I got home. I went to my office, and there was a substantial contract involving some Louisiana oil land, a multi-million-dollar deal, and they were using a business trust to acquire the title. And the bank that turned me down for the $50 check was listed as trustee. Well, you know what I did. I penciled it out and put the name of the bank to cash my check.
Yeah.
And that bank today still has that. Still has it. It gets a nice fee for being the trustee. It doesn't do any work. And they lost the business based upon a stupid thing of not cashing my check. Of course, if you talk to my wife, she'll tell you, you look like something that the cat dragged in and left.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't cash your check either.
Mm-hmm.
I really did look terrible. I was in shorts that were torn. I had a torn shirt on. I hadn't shaved in 3 days. But
to a banker, they must have thought they had plenty sound reason not to cash your check.
Right. They had every reason. I wouldn't have cashed my check either. But
yeah.
The second bank did cash the check.
Right.
And did get the business. You never
right.
know.
And that's winning your undying loyalty.
Well, it's true. And it's
pretty
guardianship.
Bad.
This guardianship stuff.
Yeah.
It's really is necessary. And the statute, I think I sent you an email with mm-hmm. the Illinois statute. And Section 3B of that statute, you should look at it. It really tells you what the law is and what's supposed to be done. The guardianship stuff is supposed to help. It's not supposed to be a predator situation. And
wow.
one of the problems that does exist, which we've talked about before, and that is the fact that what's supporting a lot of this stuff are things that are supposed to be protected. For instance, the Social Security, if you go to into a nursing home, the real cost of keeping someone in that nursing home for a month is the cost of Social Security. Now, they augment that by little problems like everyone above the age of 20 years old needs knee surgery. So immobility becomes a situation. You walk in a nursing home or a sheltered care facility or an affordable housing facility, and practically everybody there has a device to help him walk. Coincidence? Not to me, it isn't. That gets the Medicare money flowing.
Right.
And when you walk in, Dean was directed to a affordable housing facility. First thing they want is they want his Social Security, and they want him to assign his Medicare and Medicaid. And the reason is very simple. He walks in there. The Social Security will pay for practically everything. But, of course, he's going to have immobility that's going to require him to have hip surgery or knee surgery or foot surgery or something.
They'll pretty much enforce that.
Yeah, well, you see that all the time.
Uh-huh.
And now we got Medicare. That's getting it, and now they're making money on it. Now, if he files that lawsuit, and he gets any money on it, he'll no longer be eligible for living in that place. And the nursing home's worth the same situation. There's a war against the elderly, basically, what it boils down to.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Ken, because nowadays they don't look at the elderly people like they're worth anything anymore. I think it's a crying shame. They're some of the people that paved our roads before us, and they should, you know, have some kind of loyalty. What's going on with that? I mean,
is it all about the money, or what?
It's money.
To guarantee our freedom. They built the roads. Mm-hmm. They built the trucks. These people worked a lifetime saving and scrimping and saving
to
be able to provide for themselves, mm-hmm, and their families, their own retirement, and to be able to gift their children in ways that they can support their education and they can help them through their lives. And
what do you think about that? Seriously.
Well, there's another thing. There was a bunch of articles in the Chicago Tribune of how to become a judge. How do you become a judge? Here you find... You find the committee men of your particular area, and it used to be $50,000. Now I understand it's about $150,000. You make a contribution to the dominant political party.
Really?
Wow.
Now you're slated.
Are they voted in by legislator or by what, another judge or what?
We have one party in Chicago, and this would be voted in. Now you have, mm-hmm, to wait your turn. You might be appointed an associate judge, and then you have to be reelected by the judges. But you have to pay your dues, and it's a business transaction. This judge, mm-hmm, is now out $150,000.
Mm-hmm.
The judge also has to file financial reports. So he's got to find money some way. So how do you find the money? Well, there's one way. There was a fellow, Thompson Daly. He's related to the mayor and maybe related to the former governor also. He was an alderman. And he was recently indicted by the Department of Treasury for filing false income taxes. It seems what he was allegedly doing was He took out a loan from the bank, and if you wanted to bribe him, you paid a portion of his loan back.
Wow.
And where this guy made his mistake was he deducted the interest. Well, he didn't pay it. If you take out a loan and I pay it back, you can't deduct the interest. You can only deduct what you pay for. So he went to jail. And we're noticing in that Mendes case, apparently the indictment, at least from what I've seen of it, seems to be a textbook on how to bribe a judge, a senator, whatever politician you want to bribe. Mendes is accused of taking the bribes, and it's a textbook on how to do it.
Right.
Yep.
So do you think the judges, Ken, do you think the judges are part of this whole guardianship case? Because there's a lot of people saying that, no, the judges don't know anything about it. There's books out on it. What's your idea on that?
Judges are not stupid, and they're involved. Some of them are involved. Some of them are involved. A large majority of judges are honorable people.
Mm-hmm.
And even though they may have used dishonorable means to get the job, you're going to get a fair trial. In my 50-some years in practice, I'd say 90 or 95% it might even be higher than that, gave my client a fair trial and a fair shake.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there were some that weren't. And in Greylord, Racian Greylord, some were singled out. I had appeared mm-hmm. before some of them. One of them was a fellow named Holzer. And I had an injunction case coming up before him the next morning. And his wife came in the evening before to sell me insurance.
Mm-hmm.
She came in. I knew I was going to lose the case because I wasn't buying any insurance from her. Morning came mm-hmm. up. Went before Judge Holzer, and I lost my case. No question about it.
Yeah.
Can I ask you something?
Sure, go ahead.
The jury trials are being denied. Are these felonies under the RICO Act?
No. RICO Act requires you to commit a certain standard criminal act, two separate criminal acts, and you have to comply directly with the statute. What happens in jury cases, historically, foreclosures, for instance, were handled by the chancellor, and there were two branches of the court. One is the law branch, which handled something called the common counts. These were the standard laws. I owe you money. You sue me for that money in the court. You went to the law court, and you got a judgment. Those cases, under most of our statutes, you got juries automatically in that, and most state statutes have a statement. Most state Constitution have a statute that says that the jury should not be denied. In a chancery mm-hmm. court, that goes to the conscience of the king, who was a chancellor and was generally the clergyman, the king's priest or whatever the hell they called him at the time, and
okay.
he would make decisions. For instance, in an injunction case, you and I have a dispute over a piece of property, and I don't want you to sell it. So I go into court, and I tell the judge, you adjudicate who owns this piece of property. It shouldn't be sold. And the judge says, okay, I'll grant a temporary injunction on it, and I'll hear the case. And then pleadings are done, and it goes before the judge. Those type of cases do not get a normally do not get a jury. Now, in guardianship case, under the Illinois statute, there is a provision for a jury. Now, the courtrooms aren't set up for juries. It's a big
deal.
How do you get
a court to give you a jewelry trial? How do you go about that?
You make a demand. When you file your appearance, you file a jury demand.
Oh.
Do they do that with probate cases?
What if a judge rubber stamps denying jewelry trial?
If the statute provides, and our statute does provide for it, most of these statutes don't. In Florida, for instance, they've tried to become scientific. They have a panel, three people, I think it is, one of who's a psychiatrist, and they make the determination of whether or not you're competent. In Illinois, the court has to make findings of fact, conclusions of law, finding by clear and convincing evidence that you don't meet the criteria for a guardian. Now, meeting a criterion for a guardian can't have a low bar, because if I've got an IQ of 30 and I'm functioning in society, you can't appoint a guardian for me just because I get old. I'm functioning right now on my 30 IQ as I did 50 years ago. I don't have a high level. I don't understand a lot of things, but I function. If I know the objects of my bounty, the extent and nature of my property, and can do a simple transaction, go to the store and buy a bottle of milk, I don't need a guardian. I don't meet the criterion.
Yeah. Let me ask you something.
I'm sorry?
Well, somebody else send a text to me to mention on the radio show. They're saying every matter over $20 are due a jury trial, as well as all contracts. Family care of elders as well. And there's a jury witness and evidence tampering and obstruction of justice are explicitly prohibited under the RICO Act, as the Bill of Rights likewise makes clear amendments on 4, 5, 6, 7, and 14, et cetera.
Well, let me tell you something. Try filing a RICO action in the federal court. Pick the Ninth Circuit, which is one of the most liberal. Find the most liberal judge on the circuit, and I'll bet you a dollar to your penny he'll dismiss your RICO action. That you can't plead a RICO action. It's not easy, and it's not intended to be. The RICO action was intended to go after the mobsters. It wasn't intended to go after crooked politicians. They're mobsters also, but it wasn't intended, and you're not going to get very far with it. And when you get to these criminal statutes, you have a high bar of evidence. The bar of evidence on a fraud case is clear and convincing. It's not preponderance. Now, if you want to look at the Illinois statute for financial elder abuse, and it's 720 ILCS 5/17-56, if you want to look at that statute, they've reduced the bar from clear and convincing to preponderance. They have triple damages. They have attorney's fees. And they're criminal. There's criminal also. It meets all the criteria of the RICO statute, and it's reduced. It's reduced and pablumized.
Mm-hmm.
Turned into baby food. And you can't get an attorney who's willing to file it.
Yes. And then this guy is saying file or RICO directly with the federal grand juries.
You don't
and
file
United
with the grand
States
jury.
Versus,
The only one who goes before a grand jury is the attorney is the attorney general of the state, and you don't go before a grand jury. And a grand jury doesn't mean very much because a good prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich.
What?
I'm not kidding.
And then they're mentioning United States versus Clavarella. That's a case that happened. And Kids for Cash went down for RICO because there were the crooked judges.
Well,
because of the crooked judge.
I filed when RICO first, when they first recognized civil RICO, I filed two cases. First case, I got thrown out of my ear. They all, by the way, there were nine cases filed in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. I had two of them. The first case, I got thrown out of my ear. The second case, they said I had a RICO case. I tried it. I won it and wound up with nothing.
Wow.
It took a whole month out of my life. Every morning from 10:30 in the morning to evening at 6 o'clock in the evening, that poor judge had to listen to the crap I was putting before him. Hour after hour after hour of testimony was put on and cross-examination. It was almost...
Do you think that's the problem, that they're keeping us from federal grand juries?
Federal grand juries are going to be handled by the Department of Justice, and they're going to run it. A federal judge, in most instances, is going to be looking at it, and he's going to prune out anything that he doesn't like in the indictment because he's got to hear it. And you're going to wind up with a situation where you don't have control over it. You can't go in the federal court and ask the judge, I want to convene a grand jury. The men in the white coats will be there faster than you can get out of the courtroom.
Are you aware of the U.S. versus Schiavarella, the case?
No, I'm not available. There's also a case called I can't think of the name of it right now. It says that if a law is not understandable by the ordinary man on the street, it's unconstitutional. And that I can find for you, and I can send you the case.
Right.
I don't understand the tax law.
Right.
I don't understand a lot of the laws that are passed. And I'm trained, but they're not unconstitutional.
Yeah. Well, hold on a second.
The idea behind our democracy is is that everybody stands what is expected of them and does it.
Right.
But that's not how it works.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an unfortunate thing. Our society has become very, very complicated.
Exactly.
And that's part of the problem. And after you reach a particular age and you start deteriorating a bit, I used to have a photographic memory. I used to remember, my mother used to say, you even remember things that never happened. But I used to be able to remember cases.
Mm-hmm.
And I could tell you the case number. By the way, the case I was talking about is Conley versus Casualty Company.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a Supreme Court case. But today I don't have that memory.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of the Freedom Project?
I'm sorry?
Have you heard of the Freedom Project?
Freedom Project?
I've heard something about it, but most of these things have no real effect. The only thing that's going to have an effect is prosecution of someone like the Guardian in the Salas case. And there's grounds for it. This man has committed a bunch of crimes. He should be prosecuted. And if he is prosecuted along with the judge, it's gonna deter that lady Furley in the Guardian who was signing "Do not resuscitate" letters.
Rebecca
for
Furley.
Yeah. She should have been prosecuted and sent to jail for a long time. That would have
gotten rid of her.
I think she got a suspended sentence.
You're right.
Right. 3 years probation, I believe, was the outcome.
Yeah.
And you know, because in the way I'm involved tonight, the Tracy Hudson, we were at the Tracy Hudson, and she only got 8 years, and I went, "That's it." And he pissed the judge off. That judge looked at me like she was going to kill me. And I thought, well, then she's in on it. But this Freedom Project, here's the number. It's whoever wants to call him. It's 925-766-0990.
Right.
And they're trying to help people.
What you should be doing is calling the Attorney General of the state and demanding that he enforce the law. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not demanding anything unusual. Enforce the law. Here are people preying on the elderly. They're stealing from them. They're using the courthouse to do it. Why are they not in jail? They're taking people. Amy Salas doesn't have any teeth. Alice Gore didn't have any teeth. In Alice Gore's situation, they found she had gold in her teeth. They took her teeth out to recover the gold.
Oh, my God.
That happened in Illinois. I don't know if Mrs. Salas had gold in her teeth or not. But they're out. She was walking in Mobile before they took her away. Now she's an invalid.
Yeah.
Isn't that criminal?
It's criminal.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Hey, let's kind of Marcy and Ken. Yeah, Marcy and Ken. Let's bring in Elliot Bernstein. Everybody, let's bring in Elliot Bernstein. He needs to talk real quick. Okay, so Elliot.
Can I mention this real quickly?
Yeah, hold on a second.
Hey, Luann, can you mention this real quickly? Okay, so here it is. Reach out to your elected officials, grand juries, prosecutors, judge it, media. This is a text that I received. This is a Holocaust, human trafficking, and jury trial deniers, that we have the right to demand jury trials in all court cases. And if you need help, the number is 925-766-0902. Call Dr. Dave. He's an investigator, and he's trying to help people out with the Freedom Project.
Okay.
If they can get a prosecution, God love them.
Yeah,
but there has to be prosecution.
Elliot, are you on with this? Elliot, are you on with this? Okay.
I am.
Do you have a question or a comment, Elliot? We got Elliot Bernstein with us, everybody.
Thank you for allowing me to speak on the show. We're going to have a slight variation from Ken's view on things here. It is a RICO, Ken, as I've told you for the last 15 years in email correspondence. The problem is, I mean, you have two or more creditors. You got a guardian, a judge, and a bunch of crooked lawyers and bar associations and the court system. That's the criminal organization. You refer to mob. This is a mob. With two or more acts, let's start with kidnapping, murder, theft of property. I can name so many freaking acts that make you sick of what they're violating against people. This is a true RICO. And RICO, as you mentioned in Greylord, the powers were getting to be where you could start to arrest a judge, go against a prosecutor for dealing heroin out of his trunk of his car, because that's wrong in the system. Well, that system can, and maybe you're just fabled back 50 years or something in another Barney Fife moment or Andy Griffith show, and I'm not saying that insultingly. I'm just saying you're living in a different world, buddy. These people have corrupted
the entire world. I'm living in a world.
Yeah.
In a world that's
practical.
Hold on,
if you can get
someone
to prosecute, God love you.
People.
If you can get someone to prosecute, God love you. We have a state's attorney. Go to the Department of Justice. Will they take the case? No.
Yeah. Right.
Go to your state's attorney. Will he
your
take
prosecutors
the case?
No. Are lawyers. They're
well, who the hell's going to prosecute them?
Right. Well, anyway, we're not going
to
go into that kind of match. So anyway, so let's talk about that for a minute. What can you do for RICO cases? Didn't you just say you can try
well, you don't
to
determine the prosecutor determines what kind of case he's going to bring and what charges he's going to bring, and you have to get a prosecutor willing to stick his neck out. You know, if you read about Operation Greylord and how difficult it was, the government had to use tricks, basically tricks, to get a foothold. And it was...
They need to stop denying jury trials. And the people have the right to ask for jury trials.
Right.
This is the only way that's going to end.
And if you don't ask you denied, you have to take an appeal. But the problem is the fact we have to take and we elect officials. We got to elect officials that are willing to enforce the law.
Right.
I don't know how you do that, but there has to be people who will run for office and get elected and enforce the law as it's written. We're not asking. No one is asking for anything they're not entitled to under the 14th Amendment.
Right.
But the problem is,
can they report it directly to the federal grand jury and federal law enforcement?
They have to report it to a prosecutor. A prosecutor has to determine that he's willing to prosecute a crime where the elements are present. And that prosecutor, when he prosecutes that crime, has to prove each of his allegations beyond a reasonable doubt. Fraud requires not only a misrepresentation of fact, but a misrepresentation of fact that's intended to deceive. It requires, in fact, it is successful. It requires that... deception is of a nature that you have a right to rely upon it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to prove you rely upon it. You have to prove every single aspect. If I tell you my home is worth $1 million and you lend me $1 million on the home, and we're both standing outside the home, there's no fraud involved. You don't have a right to rely on my statement that my home is worth $1 million. It's worth $1 million to me. It's within the realm.
Mm-hmm.
You're making your own determination. It has to be reasonable, and you have to have a right to rely. If you don't have that element, it's not there. In a guardianship, it's the same thing. If the person knows the object of his bounty, knows the extent and nature of his property, and can buy a candy bar at the grocery store, he shouldn't have a guardian.
Mm-hmm.
There's no need for that.
Let me ask a question. I think you know, I've done a little research into the Freedom Project, and my understanding is that any citizen can organize the information that they have that they feel proves a wrongdoing and submit it to an office in a courtroom, wherever you are in America, that is the grand jury office, and ask for an investigation. Is that correct?
You can ask for anything you want. but mm-hmm. you have to go through the state's attorney or the prosecutor office, because a grand jury has to be impaneled. They're not going to impanel a grand jury because you want it.
Right.
You could bring it, but if you get
all the details,
you've got
to
stand
in his form of grand jury.
I'm sorry,
hold on, Marcy.
Federal grand jury.
I said, if you do bring paperwork that shows compelling evidence, then you've got a chance that a prosecutor will pick it up and impanel a grand jury, and things may happen from that.
That's true. If you can get all the information together, and it's certainly we have all the information together in the Salas case, in a bunch of cases that are out here in Illinois, and I send letters every day to the state's attorney's office, to the governor's office, the attorney general's office, outlining aspects of how Mr. and Mrs. Salas are being deprived of their First, Fourth, Fifth, and 14th Amendment rights.
Mm-hmm.
And Article 1, Section 12 of the Illinois Constitution. And you know what I get back? Nothing. I wrote to Senator Durbin. You know what I got back from him? I got a copy of a speech on how he's saving Social Security. That's what you get. That's what we're getting. And that's the problem that exists. We have to make inroads so the politicians know that if you don't respect the rights of the citizens, they're not going to get reelected.
Right.
Now, how you do that, I don't know.
Let me see if I can bring in another caller. I've got some static going on the line, and people are getting bounced on and off the show. So I'm really trying to keep this going here, because we've got quite a few people that want to come in and talk a little bit. Let's see if I can bring in a 937 number. Hold on a second. 937.
Hello.
Yes,
937,
ma'am.
You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Robin. Hi, Lulu. This is Brian Kendrick calling in. I wanted to ask Ken a couple of questions here. One, about the understanding of Title 18, Section 241 and 242 for deprivations under color of law. And my question is it remotely possible for a private individual to bring forth an action under that claim? Number two is that I want to clarify for the young lady before that was talking, and she was talking about the Salbrezza case, but yet at the same time talking about the Kids for Cash scandal. The Kids for Cash scandal involved Judge Monahan and Civarello. It had nothing to do with Salbrezza. Salbrezza was here in Ohio, and her case was all because of her funneling money to a certain attorney in guardianship cases and in guardian ad litem in divorce cases. And there was a very wealthy businessman there, and his name escapes me, but he was involved in the case, and that's what ended up resulting in Calabrese going and getting disbarred. But let's go back to the issue of Judge Monahan and Civarello. As you illuminated before, Ken, it was the IRS that went in and went after Judges Monahan and Civarello for income tax fraud. And then after the fact, then there was the $200 million judgment that was awarded on behalf of the victims against them. But to my understanding, to this date, no one has collected a dime in parallel with what you were saying about winning a RICO action and the IRS coming in and picking up the money. So my question is that given the state of affairs of our present-day judicial process, what do you propose when, as you have the fox guarding the hen house, as to how do a private individual or a group of individuals penetrate that wall in order to hold judges accountable when they do make errors and blunders?
You have – the problem is we have rights that we think we have, but we can't get to them. For instance, in the federal court, if you want to go into federal court, you've got to meet the criterion of getting federal jurisdiction. And that's, in many cases, is not is not easy. Most of the cases are brought under diversity of citizenship or under a federal statute, and that federal statute has to provide for the federal court to take jurisdiction over it. The jurisdiction problem in federal court is there. Most of your case is going to wind up in state court. And in state court, this is where the problem is running. When you're not running, you're not getting real complaints against the federal court judges, except in the political cases. And there you get them all the time, and some are legitimate, some are not. The only way of dealing with the state, is to throw the bastards out. I don't care if they're Republican or Democrat. If they're not going to do the job, throw them out. Organize against them.
Mm-hmm.
And get candidates in there that will do the prosecutions. We have Kim Fox here in Chicago who doesn't seem to prosecute anybody or anything. And we have a kill rate on the weekend that equals what they're doing in Ukraine. And we don't have the Russians taking and indiscriminately sending missiles at us. You can't walk downtown. People are afraid to walk downtown.
Yeah.
And we've got to organize, and we've got to get honest politicians in there. And there are enough politicians that are honest who will lead the thing or join in it. It's just a question dealing with. We've got to make it more practical to be honest than not. You know, we have a statute.
Okay, but I'd like to go back and revisit Title 18, Section 241 and 242. Is it your understanding, and do I need clarification here?
Those are the civil rights ones?
Yes.
Are these civil rights ones, friend?
Yes, for deprivation of rights under color of law.
Yeah.
And my understanding is people are saying that the only one that can bring forth that case is a federal prosecutor or a state prosecutor. And I'm saying, is that accurate?
42 U.S.C. 1983 provides a basis to bring a suit against state or federal officials who deny you your civil rights. 42 U.S.C. 1983 says it comes out of the Reconstruction era, and we do have cases. I had the Berger versus Berg case that the Seventh Circuit Court, in an unpublished decision, upheld Mrs. Berger's rights not to be humiliated in her classroom. I got thrown out of court suing a guardian because he was violating my civil rights. Court wouldn't recognize it. And the answer is there is a statute. It is the law. But it's not one of the things that's looked at. And there's another problem that exists with those cases also, and that situation is the fact that these are very expensive cases to handle, and in particular, was it Hanrahan here in Illinois? There was a black activist who. They killed in a raid, and the state's attorney's office was sued under 42 U.S.C. 1983,
mm-hmm.
which is the one you're talking about. It's a criminal statute, and this is the statute that gives you the right to sue for violation of your civil rights. And if you read it, it's very clear, and it seems to be broad. And the case went to trial. And the judge let everything in it. Every case, it was a clear-cut case where the violation of civil rights occurred, and they won in the pleading stage, and then they went to trial, and they put on a whole month's worth of evidence, and then the judge, at the close of the plaintiff's case, granted a directed verdict against the plaintiff.
Mm-hmm.
And Now they are forced to go to appeal, and the expense was enormous.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's another mm-hmm. way that they deal with you in those type of situations. And by the way, you do have jurisdiction to bring a 42 U.S.C. 1983 case in the state court. And you could bring it. There's always a way of bringing something very similar in the state court.
Right. But here,
so, Brian, did he answer your question?
Okay, yeah, but I wanted to also illuminate, though, that even though you have that right, you know, the court, it appears, will systematically shut people down so that their cases don't go forward. And Lulu, you, me, Robin, I mean, we go back quite a number of years. And, you know, after litigating cases in the court system under a 1983, 241, 242 deprivation of rights under color of law, it still baffles my mind how the court can turn a blind eye to the infractions of what occur across our nation in the domestic relations, juvenile, probate, guardianship cases, and yet these things just, it's like a railroad or a processing machine where they just turn people out and, you know, we just keep going on, and yet judges are measured to a different yardstick and should be held in a higher esteem, but yet it's been my good faith experience that I don't share the same sentiments that the judges are ethical and things, because I'm dealing with the other end of the spectrum where the ones that we're dealing with aren't, honorable and have integrity. So the question beckons, how do you get the court to take an action, or how can you get it in if the court makes an arbitrary election of choice to shut you down, even though you have all the facts and the evidence before you? What do you do, Ken?
The only thing we can do is get new people elected and make it a requirement. Make it a requirement by the population saying, we're not going to tolerate this anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, look how you appoint a judge in Illinois, in Cook County. You gotta pay off. You gotta buy the office. And it's not only there. I was told in Indianapolis, Indiana, where the Republicans are strong, you're doing the same damn thing. And every place where you have government for sale, you can't have good government.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And that people have to get together and say, this is enough. This is enough. We're not going to tolerate it anymore. And when you see some of these people, you have to make a hue and cry. For instance, in the Salas case.
Right. Exactly.
Nobody's interested. Here's a man who worked his life to have a secure...
That's
they
horrible.
Have a secure retirement, and they took it away from him. In there are other cases like it too. There's Campesino. Here's a man; he's 90 years old, and the guardian just took and threw his wife out of the house, and they're trying to sell the house. They're trying to sell it. Scans her homestead right.
Right.
And this is going on. And if you want to look at go younger, the Britney Spears case. Here's a lady who is crazy as a loon, but she negotiates $1 million of contracts and she performs them. Tell me she's incompetent?
Right. Exactly.
If I want to walk around naked, I can walk around naked. I have to pay the penalty for it. My neighbors may object.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think
right.
her neighbors. I don't think her neighbors object when she walks around naked. But
right.
I'm looking at it from a little other perspective.
So we wanted to say thank you, Brian, for calling in. If you had any more questions, because I've got a lot more callers that are hanging on here, but appreciate you calling in. Right.
We do.
Thank you. Okay, we do got another caller. Let's bring in a 770 number. 770, you have a question or a comment? Area code?
Hi, Luann. Hi, Luann. Can you hear me? This is Becky. Hi, how are you?
Hi, Becky.
Yes, we hear you.
Hi, Becky. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. I just have two questions for Ken. The first one is, are you able to give us an update on the Salas case? Is Mr. Salas allowed to see his wife?
No.
Okay.
As a practical matter, no. They basically have barred her. They have barred him from seeing her.
Okay.
And if you talk to the judge, you said there's no order. He can go see her anytime. She's not available for him to see.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is there anything that we could do as a group to help Mr. Salas where Ms. Salas could be available for him? Is there anything that we could do?
Sure. Right, Governor, whatever his name is, name escaped me right a moment. He's the guy who took all the toilets out of his house so he could file an affidavit. What's our governor's name? What's our governor's name? Huh?
Pritzker.
Yeah.
Well, that's okay. I can find that out.
You can write him, or you can write our attorney general.
Okay. And how come we wouldn't go directly for the nursing home that Ms. Salas is in? Because that is. That is really against the rights of Mr. Salas. Is there anything we could do directly with the nursing home?
You could write them, too. Actually, write the regulatory agency. The name is escaping me with the Illinois agency is. Complain about the nursing home keeping him from seeing his wife.
Mm-hmm.
They've taken everything away from him. He's living in his car.
Okay.
He's homeless, and living on Social Security. $6 million.
$8 million, rather. You say that the court says that he could visit, but the nursing homes that are keeping her away?
The guardian.
The guardian is.
Okay, the guardian. Okay, then what we need to do is contact the, like in Florida, you have the guardianship office and you report that, and then they send in the ombudsman to see what is the problem. So what we need to do is contact the guardian to put the pressure on her.
I see no problem. I've been writing them, sending them emails.
Okay.
They don't seem to care. If you can do it, that's terrific. And that's certainly things we have to do it.
Okay. I just want you to know that this is at rampant levels where they are taking husbands and wives, and you never see your spouse again. And your whole retirement is taken. This is something that needs to go on a national level. That's all I'm going to say about that subject. The next thing that I want to move on to is I wanted to talk about Mark.
Can I stop you a minute?
Yes.
There are a bunch of reports by the GAO to Congress that they've done nothing on it. If you go to Probate Sharks, there's an article there. A reprint of an article from the New Yorker magazine. Separately, there's an article from the New York Times, Huffington Post, Wall Street Journal, all on this subject, complaining about it. One damn thing has been done about it. It's all the article went out. There was a little hue and cry that lasted about 30 seconds, and that's the end of it.
Okay.
This is all.
Okay, well, thanks.
But the thing about it is, and you write the Wall Street Journal, you send to Fox News. Netflix also did a story on this.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And nothing happens. It seems everybody knows about it.
Okay.
The reason I mentioned that Probate Sharks thing is a second article. It involves some doctor who talks about the nursing homes and talks about the elderly being a commodity.
Mm-hmm. That doctor's from Florida?
No, he's from Illinois.
Okay.
But he's got contacts. He's got contacts in Florida.
Okay.
He's got contacts with the same people who, you remember 12 people died after a hurricane last year because they wouldn't move them from the nursing home.
Oh, yeah.
They have air conditioning.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah, he's part of, he's reported to be part of the same group.
Okay. Mm. All right. I'll definitely go. Thank you for that information. And the next thing that I want to touch on is when Marcy was talking about the jury trials, mm-hmm. I really believe that that is our only hope within these probate courts. And they are strongly opposed by not letting people. I can name three people. Because my husband and I were victims of this as well. I can name three other couples that said, if I would have only known that my state would have allowed a jury trial. My question is where they're getting us in the jury trials is when you ask for the jury trial, they'll say you didn't ask for it in the first pleading.
You're
and
right. You're absolutely right.
Right.
When you file your appearance, you got to file your demand for a jury trial. But remember, the fix is in these cases. You have a judge, and you have a judge there, and this judge sits in an elevated bench and is a little god. And most people who come before the court and they're serving on a jury look at that judge as kind of a father figure or mother figure and give her and him due respect. People who know the fix is in are the parties and their lawyers.
Okay.
A judge can conduct these cases with absolute regal authority, and some of them do, and they just charm the jury, and they can push a jury either way.
Right. I guess my question is that we need to make people more aware because that is a sure sneaky trick there. That, you know, because nobody, when they first go into a guardianship, I know I didn't and countless others that I know, had any idea of the predatory exposure, you know, that we would be, I mean, you just can't believe that this goes on in America. I think it's very important to let anyone know that is taken that we know that you better believe that when you make that first pleading that you want to ask for a jury trial. Now, I want to ask one more thing because there's other callers. What about if something stands alone, like your support is not connected? We're talking about now the estate process after the victim has died. And so here you are with an estate and you have your support, which can stand alone by itself without being, you know, connected to the estate. Would that still have to be under a first pleading or would that be more under the Georgia statute?
Well, I'm not familiar with the Georgia statute, but I do know after when they kill off the ward.
Victim.
Yeah, well, okay, victim. When that happens, the guardian goes in and files a final account, and that's approved.
Right.
And if there's anything left, an estate is opened. And if there's something there, if there is an executor in Illinois, it falls from the Illinois statutes that executor can ask for an accounting, a new accounting from the guardian. And the reason is we have a case in Illinois that says once the guardian's appointed, you don't have standing.
Okay.
The only one who has standing is the guardian.
Right.
And with that situation, if I don't have standing to complain, I shouldn't be barred by anything. And at that point, I assume at that point you can get an accounting. And you can get accounting from a different judge because it's not the same judge who's going to handle this case.
Well, in my case, my husband died so soon. I mean, he was already a dead man, and they concealed it from me, so they never went in and took anything. But now they're going in after the estate. What is very interesting in my situation is that all three of the people involved in the guardianship, the guardian ad litem, the court-appointed attorney, and the conservator, were all paid by the county because I had an autopsy done that would show neglect and abuse of my husband. They didn't want that to come out. So what they did was they filed $75,000 for three court hearings to the county taxpayers. Now, isn't that interesting? But that goes to show you the corruption. That how they knew I had an autopsy, they knew it was going to come out in a court hearing, so the judge closed down the guardianship, did not let me know about it as an interested party, and paid those fees instead of from the estate, paid them from the county taxpayers, which is highly unusual. But that just goes to...
There are a lot of unusual things. In these cases, there are a lot of unusual things that happen.
Right,
and
unfortunately,
you have to find an attorney who's willing to stand up against these people. And
you're not
going to
do that. I paid one $5,000 to go up against the fees of the attorney that represented me. He went in and awarded him. I learned my lesson, and I went pro se, and I'm filing everything myself. There's no attorney. That's another thing that we all need to remember. There is no attorney that's going to go in there and file on the record what needs to be put on the record. They're not going to do it, so you need to stay pro se as long as you possibly can to get everything on the record that needs to be there in case it needs to go to a higher court. Because it is exactly like you said, Ken, that any attorney that steps in will be like yourself. They will absolutely lose their license.
Well, they'll be suspended.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's why I went in and I filed everything, all the pictures, everything that happened, everything's on the record because that was the only way that I was going to get it on the record because every attorney that I would go to see, he would say, okay, no, anything that happened in the guardianship, no, we're not going to pay attention to that. And I was like, he goes, that doesn't have anything to do with the estate. I was like, that is everything to do with this estate, everything to do with it. And then
well,
I just started
right.
doing pro se.
But how do you get to the point? A crime has been committed.
Right.
A murder is committed. In the Salas case, the guardian went in and got permission from the court to arrange for funeral arrangements for Mrs. Salas. She's not dead.
Of course.
How the hell they do that? Where does the guardian even get the chutzpah to do it?
Because they know they're going to arrange that death. They know when that money's gone, right to the very dime that my husband's money was gone from that estate. Anything that would go to me that wouldn't go to them that was in the estate. They killed him. They said he's going to hospice, and within 3 days he was dead. It's just. You know, we need to let another caller take over. Ken, thanks for talking to me. I learned a lot from you tonight. Luann, thank you, and we'll let another caller go on.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you. Bye.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Boy, I tell you.
Well, everyone has grievances, and there's a frustration because our government won't enforce the law. They won't enforce
right.
the 14th Amendment.
Right.
And any attorney any attorney who doesn't go along with this is going to have a jeopardy of his own license. So we have to go to the source of this thing, and we've got to get people elected who will enforce the law.
Right.
I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to do that. I really don't.
Right. Well, you're just here to tell us what we're all up against, because we've been saying the same thing, is that we don't have a judicial system anymore we could rely on.
We don't have a government. We don't have a government that enforces the law. The law has to be enforced to benefit me, to benefit you, to my detriment, to your detriment, without regard to who I am or what I am, race, color, creed. It doesn't make a difference. When I walk in that courtroom, I'm entitled to the full benefits of the law. When you walk in, the full benefits of the law. And if we have a dispute, the courts are supposed to take care of it. And that's not what's being done. And we're not worried about it. We're not worried about it at all. And we're electing people who are interested in their own parochial interests and not us. And we have to start somewhere, maybe at the local level is where we start.
So you're also telling me that nowadays, if you go into a nursing home as well, there's a lot of dangers going into a nursing home.
Oh, God, yeah. When a nursing home, first of all, I have some experience with this because I had some litigation with it, and I looked into it. They made a mistake. One of the nursing homes we were suing said, oh, we have nothing to hide. You can go and look in books and records. So I got a forensic accountant and fellow who knew something about accounting for nursing homes, and we went and looked at it. And what we discovered was quite amazing. The nursing home business is very, very profitable. And it's basically a, you remember the Enron case? Enron had all those little corporations. It was a big fraud. Well, they're run on an Enron situation. The nurses, there's a company that furnishes nurses. They're under contract at nursing home. The doctor has a contract. The janitor service has a contract. The pharmacy is a contract. Everything is a separate contract. And management's a contract. And the people managing it make most of the profit. And the people who own it, mm-hmm. they make a nice piece of money, but they have nothing to say in it. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, they don't even know how much money they make.
Right.
So this is your nursing home situation. And the amount of money is, you remember the Esformus case?
Uh-huh.
He was the guy.
Which one?
Who, Esformus in down Miami, stole $1.1 billion from Medicare.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'll bet you a dollar to your penny that you can't spend $1 billion buying normal things and living a normal life
mm-hmm.
in your lifetime. That's how much money he stole. And he stole in about 3 months. This is the kind of money they're making.
Right.
It cost them basically your Social Security to keep you. Anything you make above it is profit.
Right.
You want to go to a nursing home, it's $10,000 a month.
Minimum. My mom was something like $13,000 a month, you know, and Medicaid paid for it.
Okay.
Medicare, Medicaid, whatever.
And how much does it cost? How much would it cost them to keep her?
It was like $10,000 to $12,000, I think it was. They said that was on the low end.
$3,000 maybe. How would you like to make $10,000 on a patient And when the doctor in that Tribune article talks about a commodity, that's who we are. That's who we are. We're a commodity. We're no longer people. You walk in there, you're no longer a person. Doctor charges for visiting you every couple days. What's his visit? He slows down to 30 miles an hour as he drives past the nursing home. You think I'm joking. I'm not.
Commodity, that's exactly what Marty Oakley would talk about. She says that we're nothing but commodities. Exactly.
That's exactly what
we hit it right on the
exactly
nail.
Exactly
right
who
there.
We are, and that's how they treat us. And the amount of money that's available here is there was a pharmacy. I can't think of the name of the pharmacy. It was owned by the nursing home people, and they sold out the CVS. I think they sold out for $12 billion. And next year, CVS made on that purchase $24
billion. Wow!
That's the kind of money. This is the kind of money we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And this is everything that everyone has said today can be verified.
Right.
Okay. Everything negative that anyone has thought about the nursing homes, the guardianship, it all can be verified.
Right. You also talk a lot about the breach of a fiduciary guardian. I know that there's not any of them that are doing it. Trying to get them removed is almost impossible.
Oh, well, the court won't enforce the fiduciary responsibility. A fiduciary has the responsibility to be reasonable, to do things that are necessary, and benefit the ward. If it doesn't meet all those criteria, he's breached the fiduciary relationship. And you mentioned this
massive amount are doing that, you know.
Yeah, we don't need any statute. The minute you call him a fiduciary, and if he steals a dime, it's income.
Right, but how do you get him removed? How do you do that?
Well, the judge is supposed to be independent, and a judge who's doing his or her job will remove him. But as a practical matter, no. Part of the game, part of the click. The fix is in. And we're not going anywhere until we deal with the fix. How do you deal with the fix? You get rid of the fixers. How do we do it? We get rid of the fixers. How do you do that? That I don't know. And that's the big problem, because we need people in government who actually do their job, and we don't have them.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Chicago, you get on the ballot as a Democrat, you're elected. We don't even have Republicans here. The Republican judges are all Democrats. We don't have a Republican Party. In the village, in the town of Cicero, the Republicans all vote with the Democrats. And in fact, the Democrats, there's such Republicans, the Democrats enforce party discipline on the Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
right.
We don't have to have political parties.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to have loyalty to parties. But we better have loyalty to us.
Hold on. So my question to you is that there's a lot of guardianship abuse. There's something like 1.5 million people in guardianship. Do you think that most of them are being abused? Do we have any idea? There's no one's keeping keeping score on this game, right? I mean, how do they know that that could be that many? How do we know that many of these judges aren't involved in this? I mean, there's obviously so much guardianship abuse. What am I trying to say? I'm trying to say is,
well, it just seems impossible to any reasonable thinking person that in this day and age, when we see such widespread and profligate abuse in so many courtrooms, it just mm-hmm. seems impossible as a reasonable thinking person that that there's not some mechanism by which judges must be on the inside of the criminal organization that's sort of running the courts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they are. They are.
Yeah.
We have, you know, it's running a court system like Cook County really, really is a challenge. The chief judge of the court has a real problem. He doesn't pick the people who are the judges. They're elected, and they're picked by politicians who they've paid off. In many cases, they paid off.
Right.
And we get some good people, we get some bad people.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to deal with the bad people. What do you do with a judge who doesn't know any law? And
mm-hmm.
we've had them. Or a judge who can't make a decision. We've had them too. Or a judge who feels that the parties ought to pay him off. And we've had that too.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with him? Okay, there's only so many you can put in marriage court.
Mm-hmm.
Probate court, in most of these cases, you can't really do any harm, but you can in guardianship. But the normal probate, a judge who can't read English could handle the duties of a normal probate judge.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a dumping place, and there are a whole bunch of dumping places that occur. What we have to do is insist on good government. And that's the key. That's the key. We've got to start somewhere. Maybe term limits is an answer. I don't know what the answers are, but people are going to have to get together, and they're going to have to throw the bastards out and start from scratch.
Yeah. You know, I was just thinking, when in Colorado, there in the case that where Luann had a judge who was obviously, in our opinion, allowing plenty of unethical stuff to go on in the courtroom. And there were a whole bunch of families that were very much aware of this because they'd all been basically cheated in that courtroom, and they mm-hmm. all got together. And we called up the police department and said, we'd like to protest about a judge. Where can we do that outside the courtroom? And they said, well, you have to stay on the sidewalk. You can't impede the progress of anybody walking on the sidewalk. They gave us the regulations that were involved, and we said, do we need a permit? They said, well, it wouldn't hurt to get one, so we got a permit. And we held protests several days in front of the courthouse with big signs and, you know, mm-hmm. people hollering and stuff. And that judge stepped down not very long after
that, about
just
6 months.
Weeks.
Yeah, 6 months.
Well,
6 months.
Yeah.
Full retirement, too. Full retirement.
No, he
but
gave
that's
up
what the
full
is about,
he
and that's what you
took
have to
early
do.
Retirement.
He took early retirement.
Yeah, well, that's democracy. That's what you have to do.
Yeah.
Right.
And you have to.
Yeah,
so
it really takes
it,
rising
it
up to put an end
the country.
To reigns of terror.
Right. Do you know anything about the USC 1983 code?
42 USC 1983. Yes.
Yes. What can you say? What can you talk about that?
Well, I did a little before. 42 USC 1983 says that in the event that a public official uses official office to deny somebody their constitutional rights or their civil rights, he is liable in damages.
Mm-hmm.
It is,
wow, do you think it's a good thing? Can you prove that pretty much in
of,
court, or do you think it's like trying to prove RICO again?
Well, I have filed a bunch of those cases.
Mm-hmm.
And I've won some and I've lost some. In the probate cases, they won't take them because the judges say we're not an appellate court, and there are several cases that sustain their position, and they say that we're not an appellate court for the probate court.
Mm-hmm.
And the minute they hear probate, they dismiss the case.
Really?
So that's part of the problem, and the judges don't like it either.
Mm-hmm.
The federal court judges do not like it, and the one case, I had a teacher who went to the aid of a student who was being attacked in the classroom. And the Chicago Board of Education decided that was unethical conduct for the teacher to defend the student in her classroom. And they harassed her, and they finally fired her. We filed a 42 U.S.C. 1983 case, and the board said, she's not a tenured teacher, so you can't bring the suit because you're suing. The only way you can sue under 42 U.S.C. 19A is to defend a property interest. So you had to be a tenured teacher. And we took it to the Seventh Circuit, and two judges agreed that property interest, it didn't have to be a property interest, a liberty interest would be acceptable. And one judge said that my pleading smacked of insanity.
Oh, God. Wow.
Wow. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
But the other two ruled, and then the Board of Education gave us a very nice settlement.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
But the problem is it's not a favored statute. You could bring a 42 U.S.C. 1983 suit in the state court. Mm-hmm. There is pending jurisdiction. And probably that's the best place to bring it.
So what happens if you...
You have to have an attorney. You have to have an attorney, and the attorney has to have some guts.
Right.
And the problem I've had during my entire career is finding attorneys who are willing to stick the neck out a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what about, is it possible to file under that statute pro se?
Yes, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You can always file pro se, and you can file with a jury demand.
Can you do a 1983 in a federal court?
You can do it in federal court or state court.
Federal or state court. There you go.
And it's not
probably not the it's
problem,
just as good to go in and
is,
real estate because, you know, attorneys charge a lot of money.
The problem is, as a layperson, the technicalities are going to eat you up alive.
Yeah.
And the attorneys defending these cases are professionals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you get by the pleadings, then you got discovery. Do you know how to take a deposition?
Uh-huh. I've done those before.
Okay. You know how to file request to admit?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No.
How about interrogatories?
I don't know how to do
you
any of those filings.
You know how to answer? Of course. And that's the problem. Because if you're up against me, I'm going to send you the maximum number of interrogatories allowable under the local rules. And when you go back and send me the interrogatories, the probability is you're going to send me one or two more than I sent you, and I'm going to go into motion to dismiss, and your interrogatories will be knocked out because you sent me more than the amount. As far as the request to admit, you got 30 days to admit or deny. And let me tell you, when I get done with the interrogatories, first of all, you're going to need a dictionary for every third word. And some of you are going to admit it, no matter whether you admit it or deny it, doesn't make any damn difference because you've admitted it. under the interpretation that, that the court will place on it. And I'll play with you across the board.
I just like you so much, I can't even tell you. You know, I just like the way that you just say it out there.
You know, I practiced law for 50 years.
Right.
I actually did practice law. I went to court.
Yeah, you're really good.
When I started in practice, we were all friends.
Right.
All lawyers were friends. We shared a ride downtown. Even my last case. The last jury case, my opponent thought I shouldn't drive home because I was so tired. And he drove me home. My opponent drove me home. We got a massive judgment and hundreds of thousands of dollars against his client, and he drove me home.
Right.
That's
wow. Practice.
That's the practice of law, as it should be.
Mm-hmm.
If we got a case on Monday in the office, I got a case on Monday. Monday afternoon, I was on the phone to the other attorney, and we'd be agreeing to whatever facts we could agree to. And,
wow.
And we agreed as to whatever law we could agree to. Then we went before the judge, and we didn't have to be called in on status calls and things. We went before the judge, and he helped us pare down the facts that we didn't agree on and the law we didn't agree on, and we set a trial date. And we were ready to go to trial almost immediately. There were some items that had to be cleaned up, some discovery had to be done, some various things, but we did them, and we went to trial and presented our case, and in most instances, it was one day of trial, and when the trial was over, everybody accepted the verdict.
Right.
And no one filed to take away your license because they didn't like you, because
right.
you beat them.
Hmm.
Right. Nowadays, if you beat a tree, they come after your license. We just got the quote here that we just got 90 seconds left to the show, which we can go into a minute. But we've got like three or four more callers. I can't get you in.
They can send an email to me at kendatkowski@yahoo.com. And
okay.
I'll answer the questions.
Tell us that email once again.
kendatkowski@yahoo.com. Ditkowski spelled DITKOWSKY.
Okay. And I'll get that out. And if anybody can't get a hold of you, please contact us at FaceUs Radio, FaceUs Radio@hotmail.com. I'll make sure I get you in contact with Ken. You've been a wonderful guest. I mean, I can't even tell you how much we appreciate you coming on. Hillary had to take off early, and Marcy had to take off, but I know that they really enjoyed having you on. And I can't tell you how I just love talking to you about all this. I mean, we sat there last night, and we talked for hours, and I was floored on how much knowledge you have and exactly what you can bring to the table for people that are having problems.
Well, I'm available to you.
What?
I'm now retired. I'm 87 years old, but I'm retired.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm available anytime.
I would love to bring you back on the show again and have you back on again as well. And we'll keep in touch with you as usually. I'm sure I'm going to have a lot of people asking for you, so I'll make sure that I send a courtesy on to them to get in touch with you if they have some issues. Okay.
Right, and we'll be happy to give out your email to those who have legal questions, so they may be forwarding you legal questions.
Right, exactly.
I'll answer the best I can.
Well, thank you so much.
We appreciate you.
Thank you. You're certainly welcome.
appreciate
Take
you,
care.
And thank you for coming on, and we'll be back in touch with you again, but thank you as well. And
ladies and gentlemen, that about wraps up our show. Remember, justice requires transparency, accountability.
And giving up is not an option.
That's right.
Okay, everybody, and I'm sorry that we've had exactly like about 10 to 15 people that could not get into the radio show. We really do apologize for that, and I really had a hard time getting some people on to the calls as well. So I kept getting people being kicked off and on. We had a full radio show.
Mm-hmm.
So that's exciting to us, exciting to you, that we could bring you all this information.
We apologize if you weren't able to stay with us. Hope you can, you know that our shows are all archived at blogtalkradio.com/hiddentruthrevealed, and you can find this show or any of our other shows there just by going to that archive. So we thank you for joining us tonight, and we wish you all well. God be with us, everyone, and thank you so much. Have a good night.
Good night, everybody. We're just going to play a commercial with NASCA, commercial of National Association to Stop Guardianship Abuse. We thank you. So good night, everybody. We'll see you again next week. I'm not sure who it's going to be, but I'm sure someone will call in and be talking on a radio show. Good night, everybody.
Did you know that elders and others are losing their rights to liberty and property? Anyone can petition a court to have a person deemed incapacitated. What if that person is you? The adult guardianship system was created to protect incompetent people and their assets. A court-appointed guardian, sometimes a total stranger, can force you into a nursing home and sell your home to pay for services. Treasured belongings can disappear as you are drugged and isolated from loved ones. Why does this happen? Unfortunately, the courts don't have the funding to supervise and audit cases. A guardian makes all decisions on your behalf, taking control of your assets with little accountability. The potential for abuse is frightening. Luckily, not all guardians exploit those under their care, but when they do, there's really nowhere to go for help. The National Association to Stop Guardian Abuse, NASGA, is working to reform adult guardianship to return it to its once noble purpose of protecting the human rights to life, liberty, and property and ending financial exploitation of assets. Are you or your loved ones protected? To learn more, visit StopGuardianAbuse.org.